You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. On April 16th, 2015, Ron Wilson presented the fourth lecture in our six-part CPN Thursday series entitled The Civil War Through Different Lenses. Listen as Wilson describes with exquisite detail the final 90 minutes of the American Civil War as it happened on April 9, 1865, and the two great men that ended it. A native of Ohio, Wilson retired from the National Park Service in 2000 after 34 years of service. He served as supervisory park ranger at Appomattox Courthouse for 25 years. Previous park service assignments included Gettysburg, Allegheny Portage Railroad National Historic Site, Johnstown Flood National Memorial, and the Lincoln Boyhood National Memorial. Mr. Wilson co-authored the Appomattox Paroles April 9th through 15th, 1865, and is a former president of the Lynchburg, Virginia Civil War Roundtable. He has also worked with Civil War battlefield historian Chris Calkins to establish Lee's Retreat Driving Tour. Mr. Wilson graduated from Miami University. During the Vietnam War, he commanded a rifle platoon and served as headquarters commandant for the 1st Marine Regiment. The lecture series was organized by award-winning historian and Charlottesville-based author, lecturer, and cartographer Rick Britton in conjunction with the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Our podcast is entitled Lee and Grant at Appomattox. Here's Ron Wilson.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, man. I brought some of these. They're back on the table. There's some good reading materials. They're free. I hope not to take many back with me. And also, there's a little brochure on Appomattox Courthouse. And if you didn't get an opportunity to go down to Appomattox at the park, when did it start? I think it started on the 6th of this month and ended on the 15th.
Ron, we need to get you, since we've got some elderly folks. Okay. Get you used to, including me.
I'm one of those. They had numerous historical programs there, and several thousand reenactors, and General Lee was there, General Grant was there, the horse artillery was there. And if you weren't there, it's a 1/150th opportunity to go. One of the things that they have, and those that go on the bus tour, Sailor's Creek to Appomattox, will get to see the original terms because they are on loan from Stratford Hall, and they're in the museum building courthouse structure at Appomattox Courthouse, so we can see the original terms that General Grant drafted, but he didn't write the terms that are on display. They're penned by someone else. Are there any questions before we get started? And if there are questions during the time, just raise your hands and we'll just kind of be open on this. Because if you're like me, you can sometimes forget why you walked into a particular room looking for something. Let's start on April 7th. General Lee had been forced out of the Petersburg-Richmond front on April, the night of April 2nd, found his way westward, always trying to turn southward and to link up with Confederate forces in North Carolina under General Joseph Johnston. But in most cases, well, the case was he was prevented from doing so by rapidly moving Union cavalry. Well, he found himself on the evening of April 7th, north of the Appomattox River, actually the third time he crossed that river, in Cumberland County, just outside of Farmville. And one of the interesting things there I found was that it wasn't General Grant that proposed initially the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia. Yes, it was General Lee's officers. They had a meeting that day after the disaster at Sailor's Creek, and on the 6th, and they concluded that they should ask General Lee to ask General Grant for provisions of surrender for the Army of Northern Virginia. And General Pendleton, Chief of Artillery, was asked to present their case to General Lee. He did not like the suggestion that the officers made and, of course, rejected it. Well, General Grant was in Farmville. He arrived there in the afternoon of April 7th, and he took domicile in the Randolph House or the Prince Edward Hotel. And he had consultation with some of his field officers, and they came up with a like conclusion, and that was to pen a letter to General Lee asking for the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia. You see, Lee had just lost 7,700 men the day before at Sailor's Creek, and he had left Richmond and Petersburg front with about 58,000 men. By the time he gets to Appomattox, he will have an army of about 30,000. So you can see the circumstances under which Grant would ask for the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia. The message was delivered. General Lee, probably at the Cumberland Church, and his response was to show it, without reading it, to him, General Longstreet. Longstreet's approach was, not yet. And so General Lee responded in a letter to General Grant, in which he indicated it wasn't time to surrender the army, but what terms would you propose upon its surrender? General Lee would then leave that evening on what would be the third night's march in a row. The army was moving day and night to avoid the federal forces. They were not in good condition. Provisions hoped for at Amelia Courthouse were never delivered. Provisions granted in 120,000 rations to be delivered on 7 train loads in Farmville were in the process of being unloaded when federal cavalry arrived. Cars were sealed and sent further westward. So the men were not in a good state. Well, General Lee, the Army of Northern Virginia, proceeded further westward then along the Richmond-Lynchburg Stage Road. And it's about 36 miles to the next point where he could obtain supplies, which was at a little crossroads called Appomattox Station. Thing is that General Grant would divide his forces in Farmville, sending the 2nd and 6th Corps directly behind General Lee, and then south of him along the railroad. The South Side Railroad ran from Lynchburg to Petersburg, and it ran through Appomattox Station, and it ran through Farmville and further east. Going along the railroad, the distance is 8 miles shorter. And going along that railroad course, federal cavalry under General Sheridan, close to 10,000 mounted horsemen, and the Army 5th Corps, Army of the Potomac, and the 24th Army Corps and the 25th Army Corps, at least 2 brigades of the 25th Army Corps, Army of the James under General Ord. I might point out that the 25th Army Corps were what they called USCT, United States Colored Troops. And there were 5,000 in those 2 brigades. Okay. So General Lee, having rejected General Pendleton's suggestion and having more or less put aside General Grant's suggestion, found himself around midnight just outside of Appomattox Courthouse. This is the night of the 8th of April. There hadn't been a whole lot of contact that day because the federal cavalry were moving south and the infantry of Army of the James 2nd and 6th Corps behind Lee hadn't made physical contact. However, there were trains loaded with supplies at Appomattox Station that had come from Farmville, 4 train loads of supplies. The advance of Lee's army going into the area was the reserve artillery. They were put in front of the army to clear more space for the infantry to march behind in a quicker pattern. And when General Sheridan arrived, actually it was Rick Britton's favorite cavalry commander, George A. Custer. When he arrived at the station that evening, he captured three of those trains, and one of the trains was got away and went back to Lynchburg. But the Confederate soldiers were denied again the opportunity to have provisions available to them. And not only that, they were blocking Lee's direct path toward the southwest and toward Danville. So now General Lee will have Federal cavalry in front of him, and will have two infantry corps directly in back of him. The question remains, could Federal infantry, who had departed from Farmville, going along the railroad behind the cavalry, cover the 28 miles to 35 miles in one day to support the Federal cavalry? That's the question. Now, they'd already marched 70 miles, so this was quite an arduous task. It's one thing to walk as an individual about 28 miles, but when you're in a group of people, it's a much harder process. Okay. So let's look at midnight, April 8th. General Lee's in his camp. He has no camp equipage there, but he calls a council of war. Council of war would consist of James Longstreet, 1st and 3rd Corps commander, as General Hill had been killed on April 2nd. Also there's John Brown Gordon, 2nd Corps commander, and the head of the cavalry, General Lee's nephew, Fitzhugh Lee. Okay. As I mentioned, the numbers of all the army would be about 30,000. In this council of war, it would be determined that the next morning, General Gordon would move his forces through the village and assault the Federal cavalry, opening a way toward, hopefully, going down toward Danville. The cavalry would support General Gordon on his right flank. However, if the Federal cavalry were supported by infantry of any substantial number, then General Lee should be notified so that he could act upon the least popular option, and that being the surrender. During the 8th, General Grant had responded to General Lee's request. What terms would he offer? And General Grant responded by saying that the men and officers would be paroled and would be allowed to return home. Quite a generous offer. General Lee responded by saying that he still didn't believe the time had come, but he proposed a meeting to take place at 10 o'clock on the morning of the 9th, Palm Sunday, between the lines of the two armies on the Lynchburg Road. Now, this meeting would embrace a much broader consideration. General Lee wanted to talk about peace. Now, peace is entirely a different situation than a military surrender. Peace embraces a political concern, and General Grant was forbidden to deal with any political questions. So, General Grant did not respond until early the next morning, the 9th. So Lee had gone ahead planning this battle operation, trying to break out, and if that didn't work, maybe he'd meet with Grant at 10 o'clock and they could work on this much broader scale. You see, General Lee had been made commander-in-chief. I shouldn't say commander-in-chief. He's the general-in-chief of all Southern armies on the 9th of February. So he was embracing all of the Confederate forces that were out in the field. Okay. Now, General Grant is at a place called Clifton about midnight when he receives this message. And he's not faring too well. He has a migraine headache, and he can't shake it. He has mustard plasters attached to his neck and to his arms. He just can't shake this terrible headache that he's in. And besides that, there's some officers playing an out-of-tune piano in there, a place called Clifton. And he has a headache, and people are playing an out-of-tune piano. And General Grant was tone deaf. He only knew two songs. One was Yankee Doodle, and the other one wasn't. Right. So, about 1 o'clock, early on the morning of April 9th, General Lee is seen as at his headquarters in a very new uniform, which he's just worn, just put on, with presentation sword, fine felt hat, gauntlets, large spurs, shiny leather boots with red stitching on them, a very handsome appearance. And General Pendleton asks him why he's so attired. General Lee responds, "I expect to be General Grant's prisoner and want to make the best possible appearance." Now, this isn't one who has great confidence that they're going to break out through the Union cavalry the next morning. But nonetheless, he would not consider the fact that he hadn't taken advantage or opportunity to take advantage of even the least opportunity to carry forth his military duty. So, the next morning of the 9th, very early in the morning, General Gordon will proceed through the village, and he will be given some protection by Southern Cavalry, about 8,000 infantry and about maybe 3,000 cavalry at the most. And they come up against the Northern cavalrymen, who are armed with repeating firearms, and they don't give ground very easily. But in kind of a left echelon movement, they move the cavalrymen off of the road and off of the ground that they're holding, and kind of like a door opens. If this is the road, they kind of swing like this and push everyone onto one side of the road, and then they would, the Southern infantry would proceed down this way toward, they were not going to Lynchburg, they're going to Campbell Courthouse, which is Rustburg today, and then proceed down through Pennsylvania County and into Danville or Hillsborough, North Carolina. Okay. And they are somewhat successful in doing that, and the road is open. But however, in the distance, they see the images of all of this blue mass which appears now in front of them. Yeah. They arrived. The Army of the James was there. Fifth Corps was there. And the Northern cavalrymen were all there. It's kind of like the cavalrymen broke away, and then right behind them, like it was prescripted that way, the infantry arrived right in front of them. And the Southerners are all kind of lined up like this, but the Northern soldiers are coming in this way, so their whole flank is exposed to this mass. And what the Fifth Corps did was they swung around on a ridge on the other side facing the Confederates, so they got Union troops facing them in the front, they got Union troops facing them on their flank, and they got two corps of Federal infantry in their rear, which General Longstreet is trying to hold in place, but there's not any fighting going on there. Yeah. So the Southern infantrymen, General Gordon, fall back through the village. And General Lee now will ride out. The Southern attack begins about 7, after the fog had cleared that morning, delaying its movement. And it's now close to 10 o'clock in the morning. It's a bright, sunny kind of spring day, probably redbuds and dogwoods, just like we see now. General Lee had now, about 10 o'clock, went out to see what he thought was going to be a meeting with General Grant, though he had no indication that through a response that General Grant was going to be there. He just assumed that he would be. Now, General Lee also at this time, because he now knew the military situation at his front hadn't gone very successfully, he sent out flags of truce. And they went out along the battle lines, and the firing began to stop as the flags proceeded. General Grant didn't show up at the 10 o'clock meeting. What are we going to do? The battle had gone badly. General Grant hadn't shown up for this 10 o'clock meeting. So, and the Federal soldiers are closing in the back and in the front and on the sides. What is going to happen? Well, General Grant, feeling that General Lee was going to resist further, had left his headquarters that morning at Clifton and began a 25-mile ride around the Confederate left flank, taking with him his staff, escort cavalry, and was out of contact with the rest of the army. A very precarious situation, to say the least. A message will be delivered through the Federal lines to General Lee, and it indicates that nothing good could come from this meeting. And he declined to meet with General Lee. So General Lee will have to now, through communications sent to General Meade, ask for a meeting that he hopes will take place to surrender the Army of Northern Virginia based on previous letters of the previous day. And Meade will agree to this, but Meade also says, in order to stop all of the military action, you must also send another letter to the troops in front of you under General Sheridan. So another letter is sent out to the troops in front of them. Well, about 11:50 that morning, firing had stopped, letters had been sent out, General Grant is approached by an officer, Charles E. Pease, a lieutenant, who has been sent by General Meade to find him. And he finds General Grant not far from Appomattox Courthouse, about 6 miles away. And he delivers the message that Lee now wishes to talk with him on terms previously offered for the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia. Now, this is not going to be a political meeting. This is entirely a military affair. We've made it a political meeting by our understanding or misunderstanding. So General Grant, get all these generals together. General Grant will draft a brief response, and he'll send a courier in to meet with General Lee. The courier is Lieutenant Colonel Orville Babcock. He has an orderly with him by the name of Lieutenant William McKee Dunn. And they'll find General Lee resting under an apple tree in Mr. Sweeney's orchard. They will deliver the message indicating that General Grant will meet with General Lee and that Babcock verbally will give General Lee permission to select the site of their meeting. Now, conveniently, the village is interposed between the two forces as flags of truce went out and is not occupied by either force. It's a neutral location. No one has any advantage here. So General Lee will mount his horse, Traveler, ask Lieutenant Colonel Charles Marshall, his secretary, and one other Confederate officer to go with him. That officer will decline. He declined. Lieutenant Colonel Walter Taylor, the adjutant of the headquarters. Taylor had been, actually, it's kind of a strange situation because Taylor, when General Lee was planning the evacuation of Petersburg and Richmond, Colonel Taylor went to the general and said, "Can I go to Richmond tonight and get married?" As if the adjutant didn't have any responsibility for the movement of the entire army out of Richmond and Petersburg. But kind of reflection on General Lee. He said, "Certainly, you may go." He rejoined the army on the 3rd of April, that is Colonel Taylor, and had escorted several federal officers on errands on the morning that took place to arrange details of ceasefire, and declined to go with General Lee up to the house. So General Lee, upon himself, would assume the entire responsibility. He didn't ask General Longstreet to go, he didn't ask General Gordon to go, He didn't ask Fitzley to go. Of course, he couldn't ask Fitzley to go. What did he do? Well, Fitzley took off with most of the cavalry when the infantry action began to fall apart and went off toward Lynchburg, leaving the army without maybe a couple hundred, maybe 1,100 cavalry left. You see, one thing in the Southern service, which was different from U.S. service, is the Southern cavalrymen and the Southern artillerymen owned their own animals. And if they were to be surrendered, what would happen to those animals? Would they be surrendered as well? And would these animals be needed to see their families through the coming year? So they rode off with those animals toward Lynchburg, and they would break up from there, and others would receive paroles and as the weeks went by. So General Lee, Colonel Marshall, and a headquarters courier by the name of Joshua O. Johns, 39th Battalion Virginia Cavalry, which was Lee's escort. And by the way, he was with Stonewall Jackson on May 2nd of 1863 when Jackson was mortally wounded at Chancellorsville. He was wounded and captured himself. But so we have the two federal officers and General Lee and his small escort ride across the Appomattox River, which is a small stream at this point because this is the headwaters. And Traveler wants to drink. And so General Lee allows Traveler to drink, and he sends Colonel Marshall into the village ahead to find a suitable meeting site. And I'll read to you what Colonel Marshall said about his instructions. Let's see if I can find that. Aha. This is from a book called An 80 Camp of Lee, The Memoirs of Lieutenant Colonel Charles Marshall. General Lee, this is his instructions. General Lee told me to go forward and find a house. Significant. He didn't want to go to the courthouse building. That's a judicial chamber. And what day of the week is it? Sunday. Is the building even open? Probably not. So we will go find a house in a neutral village. Where he could meet with General Grant. And of all people, whom should I meet but McLean? We'll talk about him in a minute. I rode up to him and said, "Can you show me a house where General Lee and General Grant can meet together?" He took me to a house that was all dilapidated and had no furniture in it. It was probably what was known as the Rain Tavern, been built in the late 1840s. It stood in front of Mr. McLean's house. I told him it wouldn't suit. Then he said, "Maybe my house will do." He lived in a very comfortable house, and I told him I thought it would suit. I had taken the orderly along with me, that is Private Johns, and I sent him back to bring General Lee and Babcock, who were coming on behind. I went to the house and sat down, and after a while, General Lee and Babcock came in. Colonel Babcock told the orderly that he was to meet General Grant, who was coming on the road, and turn him in when he came along. So General Lee, Babcock, and myself sat down in McLean's parlor and talked in the most friendly and affable way. So there's no great mystery as to the place they selected for the meeting. Now, General Lee would ascend the 9 stairs across the porch, enter the building, which has a long central hallway, and go into the room to the left of the entrance, which was the parlor. of the house. And he would be seated in a caneback chair next to a marble-top table. And we will see that in a few weeks. However, if you were waiting for someone and you were going to surrender an army and your idol had been George Washington, what are the thoughts that you might have because you have a half hour before General Grant will arrive from the field? And while there, you might have a chance to glance at a lithograph drawing that hangs on the wall beyond, above the fireplace. The lithograph drawing is a meeting or a interview between Martha Custis Dandridge and a gentleman by the name of George Washington. General Lee had married Mary Anna Randolph Custis, Martha Custis's great-granddaughter. He is related to the Custises, the Washingtons, the Harrisons, and many of the first families of Virginia. So this would be a very difficult undertaking. Robert E. Lee was 58 years of age at this time in his life. And we have to remember the uniform that he's attired in. And he was born on the 17th day of January, 1807, at Stratford. His father was Henry Lighthorse Harry Lee, who had been a Revolutionary War hero, governor of Virginia. His mother was Ann Hill Carter of Shirley Plantation, of the King Carter family. So he has a lot of cultural tradition in back of him. What else do we know about Robert E. Lee? Well, we know that his father could not manage his financial affairs and that he speculated quite wildly and that he left for Barbados not being able to pay his debts when Robert was 6 years old. His half-brother took over possession of Shirley Plantation, and the family moved to Alexandria, Virginia, where young Robert had some early schooling. But the family had no money, and if he was to get any advanced education, it would require an entry into the United States Military Academy at West Point. Now, from his mother, the young boy learned economy, moderation, self-control, courtesy, gentility, honor, and devotion to duty. So, those things are represented in this gentleman. At the United States Military Academy, he will graduate second in his class in 1829. And those at the top of the class are given the opportunity to go into the Corps of Engineers, which he does. And he has some very notable engineering projects at Fort Pulaski, Fort Monroe, and he actually saves St. Louis as a port on the Mississippi River. His marriage, he would have seven children. Three of them boys, who all later would serve in the Confederate forces, and four of them girls, and I think I'm right on this, I don't think any of the girls ever married. I don't think they could find anybody that they thought was somewhat equal to their father. He served in the Mexican War, 1846-1848, with great distinction. And in fact, Winfield Scott, who commanded the United States forces, said that Robert E. Lee was the best soldier he ever saw in the field. He would become superintendent of the United States Military Academy, 1852-1855, and would actually get to the rank of colonel by 1861. Okay. On the 17th of April, tomorrow, 17th of April, 150 years ago, what happened? 150 years ago, April 17th. Lincoln assassinated on the 14th, dies on the 15th. Virginia secedes from the Union. Yeah, 150 years ago, tomorrow. Okay. The following day, on the 18th, Colonel Lee will meet with Francis P. Blair, Sr., who the president, as a representative from the president, President Lincoln, wants to know General Lee's loyalties and would he assume command of all federal forces. And General Lee's response is that he had to follow his native state and therefore would not. General Winfield Scott said it was a decision that Lee would regret. On the 20th of April, Colonel Lee will resign from the United States Army. And on the 23rd, he will take command of Virginia troops. On June 1st of 1862, he will take command of what will be known as the Army of Northern Virginia. And he has an illustrious record. The 7 days, Second Manassas, Sharpsburg, Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, Gettysburg, Wilderness, Spotsylvania Courthouse, North Anna, Cold Harbor, and Petersburg. Long road that had brought him to Mr. McLean's parlor. Yeah. And on February 9th, as I mentioned before, he was made General in Chief of the Confederate Forces. While he's waiting, General Grant continues his ride. Remember, he's not alone. He has a cavalry escort. He has all of his staff. And he comes into the area on the Prince Edward Courthouse Road, going up to La Grande Road into Sears Lane. And just to the west of the village, he will meet General Ord and General Sheridan. Ask General Sheridan how he is. General Sheridan says, first rate. And General Grant will say, where is General Lee? And he indicates he's down in that brick house, waiting to surrender to you. Well, let's go down. So they go down a short distance, and they stop in front of the house. It's about 1 o'clock, April 9th. No, Lee's been there at 1 o'clock. It's about 1:30. It's about 1:30 on April 9th of 1865. Okay. Now, Grant had come directly from the field. So imagine his appearance. A 25-mile ride, and he was not a fancy dresser at any time. So as he ascends the steps and goes across the porch and into the room and shakes hands with General Lee, we have an immediate difference in appearance of these two officers. Lee is 5'10½". Grant's about 5'8", but he walks with a stoop. Plus, there was no cord on his hat. One of the buttons in his waistcoat was out of place. Trousers were tucked into the tops of his riding boots. He had no sword. The only thing that distinguished him from a soldier, any soldier in the Army, the Union Army, would have been the Lieutenant General shoulder boards on his coat. That would have been about it. Okay. So there's a marked difference in appearance in these two men, and I'm going to point out a marked difference in their background. Two generals shook hands. General Grant was seated behind a small spool-legged table in a kind of office swivel chair. And if you see the chair, it's kind of precarious. You don't want to lean back in it because it might fall over. He will bring with him between 15 and 17 staff officers and a newspaper reporter by the name of Sylvanus Cadwalader, who writes for the New York Herald. Grant was born Hiram Ulysses Grant on the 27th day of April, 1822. So he is 42 years old, soon to be 43 years old. Okay. He grew up in the river town of Point Pleasant, Ohio. He didn't stay there very long because the family moved just the next town over and north of there called Georgetown. And he spent most of his young boy days growing up in Georgetown. His father, Jesse Root Grant, was a rather outspoken gentleman. He seemed to be someone who knew it all. And he was convinced that he would tell you that he did. His mother, Hannah Simpson, was a more genteel type of lady. His father ran a tannery, and the young boy hated the tannery. He hated the smells of the tannery and anything associated with the tannery. And he would be told by his father, who had made arrangements with the local congressman, Congressman Hammer, that he was to go to the United States Military Academy to get his education. And the young boy resisted. He didn't want to go. But his father said, "You will go." And so he went. Now, his name was Hiram Ulysses Grant. That's not the name they had on the enrollment book. They had Ulysses S. Grant, Simpson name being in there. And so he had to become Ulysses Simpson Grant thereafter, or they wouldn't accept him. So he became U.S. Grant. What better name to have at the academy than U.S. Grant? He wasn't a very good student. Graduated 21st, I believe, of 39. He liked to read novels more than the military books. But he did set equestrian records at the academy. He was probably one of the best horsemen that came out of the academy at any point. He was assigned to the 4th United States Infantry, and his first assignment was Jefferson Barracks outside St. Louis. And there he had a friend, which he kept a good part of his life, by the name of James Longstreet, who would attend his wedding, along with a fellow by the name of Cadmus Marcellus Wilcox, another Confederate general, would attend the wedding. His wedding, however, wouldn't take place until after the Mexican War, which he went off to, served with some distinction, and learned a great deal about military supply. General Lee, you see, was always a staff officer, never in a field command other than the last years of his U.S. military service. Well, on the 22nd of August, 1848, Lieutenant Grant would marry a Julia Boggs Dent. Her father was a slave owner, of course, and owned considerable land in the St. Louis area. They would have four children, three sons and one daughter. He would be separated from his wife, being assigned to some very far western military post out in California and in Washington Territory. This had its effect on many in the military because most of the time is pure boredom. And what does one do when they have time on their hands? They play cards and they drink. and he couldn't handle any volume of alcohol. And he had actually taken an abstinence oath, and he lived that way for quite a while, but he very sorely missed his wife and family. That was just it. He was homesick, and he was bored. So one day when he was military pay officer, he was noticed to be under the influence of alcohol. And he would be asked to resign, which he did in 1854, in July 31st. Who accepted that resignation? The Secretary of War. Who was the Secretary of War? Jefferson Davis. Wouldn't he like to have that in 1864? Well, General Grant never shook the stories, those stories about his inability to hold alcohol for the rest of his life, and of course continue today. But there are very few, if even noted, instances during the war when he's actually commanding large groups of people that he's ever under the influence of alcohol. In fact, he has a chief of staff who's one of his primary jobs of John Rawlins is to make sure that no one comes in contact with General Grant and has in their possession any alcohol. He returned to St. Louis, tried his hand at various jobs, of which he failed at all of them. Of course, there was an economic crisis in 1857, which didn't help his situation at all. Poverty actually stared him in the face, and he had to pawn his gold watch to buy Christmas presents for his family. In 1860, in April of that year, he was offered a clerkship in his father's leather goods store, which was now in Galena, Illinois. And he will have an opportunity to meet a man we'll talk about later, Ely Parker, while he's in Galena. And if you haven't been to Galena, I think you should go, because I think it's a very interesting place. I was there last fall. Well, with the backing of the local congressman, Elijah Washburn, this cashiered officer is now given command of an Illinois regiment, a bunch of ragtag farm boys. He whips them into shape. And in 3 years, he will become Lieutenant General in the United States Army. In 3 years. His Civil War career is very illustrious as well. Fort Donelson, Shiloh, Vicksburg, Chattanooga, and of course the battles here in Virginia. On the 3rd of March, 1864, he's asked to come to Washington and to meet the president. And on the 9th, he's promoted to lieutenant general, the only one to hold that rank on a permanent basis is George Washington. 3 days later, he's given command of all field forces. And generally, one having that rank and that position stays in Washington. But he didn't care to stay in Washington. And he came out to the field. And he took his position with the Army of the Potomac. Though he didn't command the Army of the Potomac, that was George G. Meade. So we have men of different backgrounds and different appearances here. And I might add that in this meeting, which will take about an hour and a half between these two officers, Grant will continue with the habit he'd picked up during the war, smoked cigars. And there's probably no reason to think he didn't smoke cigars during this meeting as well. He was now smoking, chewing, giving away 20 cigars a day. And when he's age 63, he will die of throat cancer, the same age that Robert E. Lee will die, 63. Okay. Well, the two officers meet, and they began their discussion not about what had brought them there, but did they remember one another during the Mexican War? If you've ever been around military people, they always go back to some reminiscence. Were you at this place or that place? Oh, I remember here, and so forth. So this goes on, and there's a question, well, did Lee actually remember Grant? Because what had happened was General Grant had gone from the field over to see General Lee. Well, he actually went over to Scott's headquarters, and General Lee at that time was a young captain who was headquarters chief of staff. And when the young lieutenant reported, he was in the field uniform, and Captain Lee said, "It's required when you come to the general's headquarters that you be dressed in the uniform of the day." So the young lieutenant had to vacate and come back with a more proper uniform. Would General Lee remember that? Well, some say he did, and some say he didn't. But Colonel Marshall said that General Lee did recognize General Grant, and he had a much closer association than probably anyone else. So we'll kind of leave it at that. So this discussion went on for some time, at which point then General Lee would interrupt the conversation and remind him of the purpose of their meeting and would he be kind enough to draft the terms that he proposed. General Grant said he would do so. Now, we know a little bit about Grant. We know quite a bit about General Lee. Now, what instructions had General Grant given should this meeting take place? Did he have a manual that he could open up and say, surrenders are conducted this way, and you have to do this and you have to do that? Well, not exactly. You see, General Grant was probably the most experienced person in the country on military surrenders. He'd accepted the surrender of the garrison at Fort Donelson under no terms, unconditional surrender. And there was always that thought, would he try this or do this again on another occasion? But he didn't. The Vicksburg surrender in July of 1863 surrendered the entire garrison, and he gave them provisions that they could go home. Now he would be involved in a third surrender. Okay, so he has some experience. Now, instructions. Well, he met with the president on the 27th and 28th of March aboard the steamer River Queen at City Point, which is today's Hopewell. And they discussed events that was it necessary for another campaign, and if they surrender, what is the president's desire? The president indicates that he wants the men to be allowed to go home. Okay, so he has some instructions. He will meet again with the president on April 3rd in Petersburg. So he has some instructions. He has some experience. Now the question is, can he put that in writing so that there's no misunderstanding of what the intentions are? Because you know how people can put a comma in the wrong place and it changes the entire context. Well, it seems that the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant are still on the bookshelves in the bookstores today, 150 years later. Considered one of the best forms of English autobiography that has ever been written. General Meade said you only needed to understand General Grant's reading, or needed to read it once, and the full meaning and complicity was there. There was no second meaning to it. So he's a very good writer, he has experience, and he has instructions. So he will then begin to write out the terms of surrender. He calls for his manifold order book, which he dictates all of his military orders. It's set for 3 copies. It's like an early Xerox machine. It has carbons underneath the pages, and it transfers onto that. And if he needs to write out an order, It can then be easily copied, cut out, and sent to someone, and it's in the handwriting that is recognizable as General Grant. Okay. So he will begin to write. And he will write 2 pages in the manifold book. He will then, with officers present, reread it to themselves, interline a few words, and then General Grant will arise and will hand to General Lee this draft. It's not formalized yet. It's a draft. How often in the course of human history do you present your opponent or your business associate a draft? Because a draft implies that there is room for perhaps inclusion. Grant's looking for participation. And this happens. Now, what were General Lee's feelings? Well, in Grant's memoir, he had this to say. What General Lee's feelings were, I do not know. He was a man of much dignity with an impassible face. It was impossible to say whether he felt inwardly glad that the end had finally come or felt sad over the results and was too manly to show it. Whatever his feelings, they were entirely concealed from my observation. For my own feelings, which had been quite jubilant upon the receipt of his letter, were now sad and depressed. The headache I mentioned that General Grant had when he got that message from General Lee, his headache disappeared. Okay. General Lee noted that the word exchanged had been left out of the draft, and asked permission to include the word. General Grant said he thought he'd included it and certainly had meant to do so, and General Lee certainly could include the word and put a caret in the appropriate location. But he couldn't do that even because he didn't have a pencil. He searched in his uniform coat for a pencil but couldn't find one, so Horace Porter on General Grant's staff lent him a pencil. And if you go to the Courthouse Museum, you can see that pencil. It's kind of strange because Porter's young daughter, when she was growing up, had access to that pencil. And you see teeth marks on the top of it. So watch your treasured possessions. General Lee noted that the terms would be quite generous. The officers and men of the Army of Northern Virginia would be paroled and allowed to return home. The munitions, public property, would all be surrendered later, formally. The officers could retain their sidearms, their personal baggage, and their horses. Now General Lee had a question. Since the men of his army, as we pointed out before, provided animals at their own expense, would they be allowed to retain those horses as private property? General Lee Grant said, no, the terms do not allow for this. General Lee, upon rereading the terms, said, I see they do not. But he would not ask for a concession. General Grant, perhaps reflecting on some of the hardships of his earlier life, and knowing that most of the men in the army were small farmers, they would need those horses to put in crops to see them through the coming winter, and said, I will not change the terms as written, but at the proper time, any man that claims to own a horse or mule can take it home with him. General Lee thought this to be particularly generous of General Grant and said it would have a happy effect upon his men. Now, that story probably has gotten a wider distribution than we know what the record shows, like most things in history. We have history and we have perceptions of history, what we want to believe. Parole records indicate about 600 horses were taken. at least that were noted. It's not written down how many horses with U.S. brands on them left Appomattox Courthouse. The terms were returned to General Grant to have them drafted into a formalized manner into ink. And the terms were given to Lieutenant Colonel Theodore Bowers to begin that process. But Colonel Bowers became quite nervous and could not complete the task. And in fact, I'd like to read you what Charles Marshall had to say. The terms will be copied in ink by another federal officer by the name of Lieutenant Colonel Ely S. Parker. Colonel Marshall said, General Lee told Colonel Parker to copy his letter, which was written in pencil, and put it in ink. Colonel Parker took the table and carried it to the back to a corner of the room. That's the table that General Grant had used. Leaving General Grant and General Lee facing each other and talking together. There was no ink in McLean's inkstand, except some thick stuff that was very much like pitch. None of the federal officers had brought any ink with them. They had come directly from the field. But I had a screw boxwood inkstand that I always carried with me in a little satchel that I had by my side. And I gave it to Colonel Parker, and he copied Grant's letter into, with the aid of my inkstand and my pen. Let me tell you something about Colonel Parker. Colonel Parker's not a citizen of the country. He's a Seneca Indian. Indians were not citizens of the country till 1924. So at this point, we're going to have the terms copied by a non-citizen using the adversary's ink. Once completed with his task, General Lee will instruct Colonel Marshall to draft a letter of acceptance. A draft is prepared. General Lee requires, however, different wording, and instructs Colonel Marshall to prepare another copy. But Colonel Marshall does not have paper, so they had to borrow paper from the federal officers. I guess if there's any symbolism that takes place in this room, it's that fact that you recognize someone for their ability and not their birthright. And that if the country is going to succeed, it's going to have to use the human and physical resources of all of its inhabitants and geography. In the meantime, General Lee and General Grant had come together. And General Lee indicated to General Grant that he had federal prisoners which he wished now to return to him. And they were not faring well, as he hadn't been have adequate provisions, as we previously had talked about, to give to them. General Grant desired to have the men back as quickly as he could and asked, how many men does the Army contain? And General Lee said, I do not know. He'd been on constant movement, loss of many men in battle, desertion. General Grant indicated, would 25,000 rations be enough? And General Lee said that would be more than ample. General Grant would indicate to Colonel Morgan, or General Morgan, to have provisions brought forward for the Confederate soldiers. Where would they get 25,000 rations? What about those rations that have been captured now at the rail depot? And the trains that have been in Farmville had actually been captured by Federal cavalry at Pamplin the day before. So Federal Army had plenty of rations. General Lee was introduced to the officers in the room, the federal officers in the room. And with this, I will conclude my remarks. No, I got a couple more things here I can probably tell you about. Introduced to the officers in the room, General Sheridan, General Ord, et cetera, and the others. And finally to Ely Parker. And he kind of recognized Parker as not being a white man. He was a native born. General Lee had been out on the western frontier on assignment. And he recognized Parker and said it was good to see one real American here. Which kind of concludes really what this meeting is about, because Colonel Parker's response was, "General, we're all Americans." General Lee would shake hands with General Grant, go out into the porch, call for his horse, the orderly, to bring it forward. And as he did so, there was a federal band across the road, the 198th Pennsylvania Band. And they struck up an air, which was fairly new at the time, called Old Anxine. And General Lee would then ride back to an ordeal more strenuous than the hour and a half he'd just spent to tell his men that had followed him to this point that they had been surrendered. Marshall said this: there was no theatrical display about it. It was itself the greatest tragedy that ever occurred in the history of the world, but it was the simplest, plainest, and most thoroughly devoid of any attempt at effect that you can imagine. Charles Francis Adams said, referring to Appomattox, as the most creditable episode in all of American history, an episode without blemish, imposing, dignified, simple, heroic. Grant may have transcended the bounds of his military authority by defining the consequences of the people parole he was extending to Lee and his men, by saying they were not to be disturbed by United States authority so long as they observed the paroles and the laws in force where they might live. There would be no prosecutions, no trials, no treason, no reprisals, no revenge, at least not from the military. Defeat was punishment enough. It established a foundation for reconciliation and reunion. It was marred 5 days later in Ford's Theater. Having waged relentless war, Grant endeavored to make sure that victory brought with it a peace worth winning. There was a young captain on General Grant's staff whose father occupied a building in Washington at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Captain Robert Todd Lincoln. He was at the meeting. He would go back to Washington with the general and have breakfast with his father on Good Friday, the 14th. The father was very interested in what had taken place during that meeting and what General Lee's response was. He would invite the young son to attend the theater that evening, but the young son, having returned from the campaign, was tired and said he would like to rest. That was the last time he actually saw his father alive, other than unconscious in the Peterson house. A fellow by the name of Gamil Bradford left us this about the year 1900. In all of this scene, two figures stand out beyond every other: the man who succeeded and the man who failed. In some respects, there are remarkable resemblances between them. Though one had old family traditions behind him and the other had not, both were absolutely simple, democratic, and indifferent to fuss, parade, or show. Both were frank and straightforward, yet both were men of extreme reticence, using as few words as possible and only for the deliberate conveyance of their purposes. Both, under a calm, if not frigid, exterior, covered tender human sympathy and warm human kindness. But one was a man of the 18th century, the other of the 19th, one of the old America, the other of the new. Grant stands for our modern world with its rough business habits, its practical energy, to its desire to do things no matter how, its indifference to the sweet grace of ceremony and dignity and courtesy. Lee had the traditions of the older day, not only its high beliefs, but its grave stateliness. Its feelings that the way of doing things were almost as important as the thing being done. In short, Grant's America was the America of Lincoln, Lee's the America of Washington. This was a dividing line between the old and the new. In an hour and a half. And then one last thing, if you will. Its true unity of our nation is more than a union of states. It is a unity of spirit, of human hearts and aspirations and hopes. It is not static, but is ever changing. The spirit of American unity is one of challenge, of new goals to be sought and won. It is the spirit of ceaseless striving by Americans of every generation. Appomattox stands not as a memorial to war, but to peace. It is about honor, compassion, dignity, and the spirit of how we became one nation. Thank you for your attention. Now, I know there's got to be some questions out there.
I had a question earlier about the missing furniture.
Oh, yes, missing furniture. Well, it became someone else's treasured possessions. And did I keep that or not? Yes, no, I did. Yes, I thought I did. Yes, I always get that question. After General Lee departed, General Grant remained behind, issued several orders for an official ceasefire, etc., and how the troops were to leave Appomattox, etc. Various other officers who were present and those some that were not present came into the parlor, and as we are so prone to do, gather mementos and keepsakes. Do I have the right one here? No, that's not the right one. I've got to get the right card. Yeah, here we go. General Grant's oval, just small little oval spoolhead table made of pine, was, kind of use this word loosely, purchased. Because the McLean family says nothing was for sale. And I really didn't tell you much about the McLean family. Let me tell you a little bit about them. Wilmer was an opportunist. He married a wealthy widow by the name of Virginia Beverly Ho Mason. And she had a fine home in Northern Virginia near a place called Manassas, called Yorkshire. And when Wilmer married her, he had been a wholesale grocer. But now he became a gentleman farmer on this 1,200 acres, 14 slaves. The war broke out, of course, his home was right in the midst, as Rick well knows, the First Battle of Manassas. Well, it wasn't actually in the midst, it was on the periphery, but it was nonetheless used by General Beauregard for a time being. Wilmer would later move to Appomattox after the birth of their fourth daughter in 1863. Now, at the time that Colonel Marshall approached looking for a meeting site and Mr. McLean volunteered the use of his home, Wilmer was 50. His wife, Virginia Beverly Ho Mason McLean, was 47. She had two elder daughters living there in the house. There were five children living in the house. And at 47, she was pregnant. Now, I'm sure all the ladies in this room would not look kindly on their husband inviting some muddy officers to traipse into their house, particularly in the conditions of that she had at the time. And I'm sure that later he may have heard about it. But nonetheless, nonetheless, there's going to be some furniture that are going to become possessions, and perhaps because they did become possessions, they still exist today, and so forth. But Grant's Oval Table, General Sheridan said he paid $20 in gold for that table, and it is in the Smithsonian Museum, and you can see it in Washington. Lee's marble top table was purchased by General Ord for $40 in greenbacks. And by the way, this is the first time in the nation's history that you have one uniform currency, printed money. That table, the marble top table generally used, is in the Chicago Historical Society. I might add that Grant's table, which was purchased by Sheridan, was given to General Custer. And he was seen riding off with the table over his shoulder. Not to be outdone, Grant's swivel chair was obtained by Brigadier General Henry Capehart, who was a brigade commander in Custer's division. And that's in the Smithsonian. Lee's caneback chair was obtained by another cavalryman, Colonel Edward Whitaker, and that's in the Smithsonian. I might add that the table, the chairs that are in the Smithsonian and the table, the one table that's in the Smithsonian, were borrowed by the Park Service back in the late 50s, one item at a time, and taken to a furniture manufacturer who specialized in antique furniture and replicated exactly for the parlor at the McLean House. So you don't have the originals there, but you'll see their likeness. There were candlesticks on the table where General Lee sat, and they were obtained by Brigadier General George Sharp, who's the assistant provost marshal, the police. That's in a park exhibit. There was a young, there was a rag doll in the room that was the possession of 8-year-old Lucretia McLean, one of her playthings, and it had been left in the park. And as federal officers came into the room, they put it up on the mantle. And then later, after the meeting, they kind of tossed it around amongst themselves. And it was taken by Captain Thomas W.C. Moore. And the doll has a name. It's called the Silent Witness. The mantle vases, they're in the parlor today. The sofa is in the parlor today. The secretary bookcase is in the parlor today. So those things are still all there. That's pretty much. Now, the bookcase obviously is too big for soldiers to carry out. But, and they weren't interested in a sofa that's also too big. They weren't interested in vases, but you know, the other, and they didn't play a role, they were just happened to be items in the room. So those items still exist, and you can see some of them, and they probably exist because they were taken. Yes?
Where was the McLean family while this meeting was taking
place? Well, I can guarantee you that his wife was not there during when this was taking place. They were probably downstairs because it has an English basement. And there is reference there that one of the participants said that Wilmer may have been involved in the search for Hink. So he was close at hand during this process. I might add that he tried to make some money off of this later. He asked General Lee for 2 sittings to get his likeness, and General Lee declined that invitation. But he went ahead and published a lithograph drawing of the room and officers. There's some historical inaccuracies in it. And he borrowed quite a bit of money to underwrite this venture after the war. But there weren't any Southern homes that wanted a picture of the surrender hanging above their mantle. So the venture failed. And it put him into financial difficulties. And the house was sold in 1867. He moved back north to Alexandria. And he had a job with the Port Authority, and then another time he had a job with the Internal Revenue Service. Aha. Uh-huh.
Was it rebuilt again?
Yeah. Question about the house. Yeah, he worked as a gauger for the Internal Revenue Service. Well, the house was dismantled in 1893 to be taken to Washington to be re-erected as a museum. But the venture failed financially, and the materials were just left piled up there to rot and be carried away. I don't know how many buildings in Appomattox have McLean bricks in them. But the venture failed, and the buildings were left just to disintegrate. But the architectural drawings specifications survived. And using those drawings and the specifications, and also there's a picture over here which shows the McLean family taken in the fall of 1865. There's pictures of the house. So using all of that information, they're able to put the house back. And 1/12 of the bricks in the house are from the original. So, yeah. Any other? I'm holding you all for your dinner, you know.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.